I want to make sure our folks in Juneau and actually...
What sites do we have on?
Okay. Juneau and Anchorage, I guess, is all that we have on currently. Are you hearing us all right in Juneau? Does anybody hear us in teleconference land? Anchorage or Juneau?
Senator, we're here in Juneau. This is Annette Kreitzer from Senator Lehman's office.
Hi, Annette. You coming through all right then?
Yeah, we can hear you. We just need you to speak up a little bit, Senator.
Okay. Yeah, okay, thanks. How about Anchorage? They're on, aren't they? There's just nobody there. All right, we'll go ahead and proceed. I guess if Anchorage can holler in if they're not hearing us clear enough. First of all, for the record, we have with us Senator Wilkins, Senator Olson, Representative Davies, Representative Jewell, Representative Ogun, Representative Fate, and myself, Senator Torgerson. Senator Kelly will be joining us momentarily. He called in and had a conflicting meeting for the first half hour. We will. Oh, and Representative Whitaker is still with us out in the audience. Oh, there he is. Yeah, thanks. Who is going to sit out there. He had to run and get some other work done this afternoon, so he's going to listen in for a little while. We'll try to stick to the agenda as close as we have presented. We do have one change and one addition at 5 o'clock tonight. At 5:30 tonight, we'll have the North Slope Borough on as public testimony, and they will allow them more than the three-minute timeline. And then we are switching the Governor's Council for the Gas Committee from tomorrow's calendar over to this afternoon to accommodate Charlie Cole and Jim Sampson, who both have to be down in Anchorage for the subsistence meetings tomorrow, so we are going to switch that. Then we got word from Senator Stevens' staff that Senator Stevens would like to come and testify himself before the committee tomorrow afternoon, so we're trying to work that out too, so that he possibly would be an addition to the agenda 5 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. And that's the logistics of that are still being worked on. So with that, we'll roll down the agenda as we have presented. Any questions from anybody? I guess you have to talk right into these mics. So when you get all our testifiers, talk directly into the mic. First, we're going to start out with the Department of Revenue. We have Commissioner Condon here. We all remember Senate Bill 158, which directed the Department of Revenue to look into ownership, potential ownership of the state of Alaska, either in part or all of the pipeline. Possible port authority concept or possible corporation where Alaskans could buy some of it and so forth. The commissioner has selected two companies to proceed with that study, and we have one of them that's joined him today, and I'll let you introduce him, Commissioner, when you come up. So,
Senator Torgerson?
Yes.
This is Johnny Ellis at the Anchorage site. We've been here since the beginning. There are four of us here, my aide, Hugh Wade, Sandy Byrd, an aide to Senator Lyman Hoffman, and Harold Hines.
Oh, great.
We can hear you loud and clear and appreciate the teleconference.
Okay, thank you, Senator.
Okay, do I need to do any? I'm live on the air here. Okay.
Yes, you're live.
All right. For the record, my name is Will Condon. I'm the commissioner of the Department of Revenue. I'm here today to talk very briefly about the work we've undertaken with respect to Senate Bill 158, which was enacted during the last session of the legislature, and it directed the Department of Revenue to undertake a fairly detailed study with respect to possible state financial participation or some other form of state assistance in the financing of commercialization of North Slope Gas project. As I reported in your July hearing, Mr. Chair, we were in the final stages of completing contract negotiations with the CH2M Hill and Petrie Parkman firms. We have completed those negotiations. They've commenced work. We are assisting them in some of the legwork that goes with this project. We are not we have not reached a point where we really have anything to report other than that we were doing the work. We have talked to some members of the committee about some specific aspects of the project. We've interviewed a number of Alaskan leaders about their views on the pros and cons of state ownership, and that's really where things sit. With me here today is Bill Garner, who's with the one of the two contractors, the Petrie Parkman firm. They are an investment banking firm specializing in the energy industry. They have offices in Denver and Houston. And I thought it would be helpful for Mr. Garner to just briefly introduce himself and his firm so that you have an idea about what he looks like and what it is they believe they can help us do. So with that, I'll turn the microphone over to him. I'll pass out a little couple of page resume of the firm, which you can read now or later. So, Bill, you want to proceed?
Get the handout from the commissioner. Thank you, Commissioner, Senator. What I thought I would do is briefly describe our firm, talk a little bit about me, since I'll be the lead person on this project, and talk a little about the requirements of Senate Bill 158 and how we, CH2M Hill, and the commissioner's office are going to proceed to prepare that report. First, about Petrie Parkman and Company, you don't see us in Alaska. We are very active in other parts of the world. In fact, we are the world's leading oil and gas investment banking specialist. All we do is oil and gas, which differentiates us from other investment banks like you hear about in New York City who do a wide variety of things. All we do is oil and gas, and we're the leading world's firm in doing that. We provide a full suite of services in this industry, ranging from divestiture and merger advisory services. We do strategic advice. We do equity research. We do sales of securities. We do underwritings. We do private placements. We have a bankruptcy practice in this industry. And we advise governments on various energy-related initiatives. We were founded in 1989. The founders are the former lead investment bankers from First Boston Corporation. When Credit Suisse merged with First Boston, these gentlemen left and formed this firm. Today we have offices in Denver, Houston, and London. The way we're organized, our capital markets operations are exclusively handled in Denver, which that would mean our research, our IPO activities, anything having to do with writing research reports on other companies, providing very high-level strategic advice to various companies, and handling financial aspects for companies is handled in Denver. The Houston office, which is where I am, handles mergers and acquisitions, transactions, and our advice to governments. We have approximately 35 specialist professionals. About half are out of the investment banking business, and about half, including me, are out of industry. Now, we've, in the past 12 years, have closed over $35 billion of oil and gas mergers and acquisitions in somewhere over 250 separate transactions, which makes us one of the most active firms in the world in this business. We have been named the best energy research boutique by Institutional Investor Magazine on numerous occasions, And according to the Petroleum Economist magazine, in 2001, we were one of the world's leading investment banks in terms of the monetary value of oil and gas transactions that we've closed. We talked, I mentioned earlier about our governmental practice. Two of the major projects that we've worked on for governments that we believe most people know about, one would be the representation of the United States government, in specifically the United States Department of Energy in the Clinton administration, in the sale of the Elk Hills Strategic Naval Petroleum Reserve, which we handled for the government, and that resulted in the largest monetary privatization in the history of the United States. That reserve was sold to Occidental Petroleum Company several years ago. Currently, we are advisor to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in the largest natural gas investment project in the world, which is their natural gas initiative, where the kingdom, in essence, is reversing many years of policy in developing their hydrocarbon reserves themselves to a situation now where they're encouraging the largest oil and gas companies in the world to invest approximately $20 billion in integrated natural gas projects within the kingdom over the next 10 years. This includes not only exploration and production, but the construction of pipelines, processing facilities, petrochemical plants, power plants, and desalination plants, the fuel for which of each of those facilities would be natural gas. And Saudi Arabia is believed to have some of the largest natural gas reserves in the world. We began that project roughly 2 years ago, and we're heavily in the thicket of it now. We announced the winners of the bidding rounds, signed the first agreements with those companies in June of this year, and we're now assisting the kingdom in drafting definitive documents for that investment. We also have been active in the lower 48 in various transactions. One of the major projects we worked on this year was defending Barrett Energy Company in a hostile takeover attempt by Shell Oil. That eventually led to an acquisition by the Williams Companies. In the handout, there's various other projects we've worked on. There are numerous others, but these are just some things that we thought you might have an interest in. In terms of the people who will actually work on this project with me, Mr. Petrie and Mr. Parkman both will assist. Mr. Petrie his involvement is primarily in advising chairman of companies on strategic matters and also in directing our research activities. He is a graduate of West Point. He is a past member of the board of directors of the National Association of Petroleum Investment Analysts and has served as president of that organization. He has served on the Securities and Exchange Commission's Advisory Board on Oil and Gas Accounting and has delivered a number of technical papers to the Society of Petroleum Engineers on the subjects of petroleum valuation, merger and acquisition trends, and energy policy. He also frequently appears in the media. He is interviewed frequently on TV programs such as Wall Street Week, McNeil Lehrer NewsHour, CNBC, Fox News, on a whole variety of energy policy matters. And also he is frequently quoted in Barron's magazine and was in the most recent issue of Barron's talking about what's going on in the energy industry, the hydrocarbons energy today. Mr. Parkman heads the Houston office. He began his career in industry and later became the head of oil and gas mergers and acquisitions operations for the First Boston Corporation. And then there's me. I head the firm's international practice and am also the pipeline guy. My background is in natural gas pipelines. I was the former general counsel of the fourth largest natural gas pipeline company in the world in terms of miles of pipe, which is KN Energy. KN has since merged with Kinder Morgan, Inc. KN and Kinder Morgan are not active in Alaska. After serving as general counsel, I was appointed head of the international group at KN and then began my work with Petrie Parkman roughly 18 months ago. where I primarily work on pipeline projects and international projects. In terms of Senate Bill 158, I certainly don't need to lecture any of you about the requirements of that bill. We have begun preliminary work on that transaction with the commissioner's office. As the commissioner testified, we have begun the first process, which is talk to the stakeholders. I think it is critical before we dive into some of the details of this to get a better understanding of what citizens, legislators, proponents, and opponents might have to say about this idea. And so CH2M Hill and some staff of the commissioner's office has undertaken those interviews in the state of Alaska. We at Petrie Parkman are going to talk to the companies and the proposed project developers to get their sense about these requirements. It's just important, we believe, to find out where they're coming from and what they think. So after that's done, we will then dive into the remaining part of this examination. For example, we're going to examine the history of state participation in TAPS and in other natural gas pipeline proposals as they have come up historically within the state. We're going to determine the current status, obviously, of the various gas pipeline proposals. We're going to identify and quantify the key uncertainties associated with project development, such things as construction costs, operating costs, tariffs, throughput, et cetera. We're going to examine the available financial participation options of the state, such as full ownership, partial ownership through public or private corporations or other entities. We will look at the sources of funds, such as sources of equity, for example, could be the permanent fund, the constitutional budget reserve fund, the permanent fund, earnings reserve fund, various other things. And then we'll look at debt alternatives, which would include revenue bonds, general obligation bonds, et cetera. We'll look at the feasibility of state guaranteeing private debt or state guaranteeing debt in general, and other alternatives such as state ownership, not of the pipe itself, but of the capacity within the pipe. After we've done that, we will develop the evaluation criteria as to what would be in the best interest of the state, such as what kinds of returns the state should be looking at, what kinds of impact, what's the impact criteria of the state's cash flow, what would be the impact of the state's bond rating, what would be the impact of availability on state credit to fund other essential public services, look at the conflicts of interest kinds of issues associated with state ownership of in such a project, with also the state's obligation to regulate various aspects of such a project. We will look at generally economic development within the state and impact of the natural gas pipeline project and participants in such matters as the project cost, the feasibility of the projects, project timing, project participants. Then we will evaluate the various options against the evaluation criteria and then come up with recommendations as required by the Senate bill. And that will be our work that we will undertake. We're doing it now. We will certainly do this in the fall. The report is due to the legislature no later than January 31st of 2002. And I know the commission will be making periodic progress reports.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you. That seems like you're well qualified.
Thank you.
For sure. I just have one question, then we'll see what the panel has. But are you familiar with any other governments that are, particularly in the United States, that are part owners in lines or similar studies that you might look at and compare us with?
In the United States, early in the history of this country, not in the history of this country, but early in the history of the development of the natural gas industry, there were situations where this occurred primarily as economic development initiatives, where states and local governments would participate in projects primarily as a means to either stimulate investment or to meet some other political or environmental concern. For example, I'm familiar with Denver. When Denver got natural gas, one of the issues there was to take the community off coal because of the air pollution issues and put it on natural gas, and there was a lot of state and municipal activity at that stage. But at the present time, it's not common. We're going to examine where that might exist today, but it's not certainly not a common feature in the development of the industry today. Now, internationally, it is. Certainly in the case of Saudi Arabia, where we're working, the Saudi Arabian government intends to take equity participation interests in certain of the projects. And the reason they're going to do that would be their perceived rate of return, security issues for the kingdom itself. They hate to turn over certain strategic parts of their infrastructure over to non-Saudi entities. You see these kinds of activities in just a lot of places where you have state-owned oil companies, Mexico, mm-hmm. for example, Indonesia, places like that. But but it's a different situation than what you have. There probably is some analogies that can be drawn, and maybe some ideas that can be drawn here. But typically in those countries, you're dealing with different problems altogether than what you have here.
Questions? Go ahead.
Can you comment on rate of return issues? For a company investing, there's different rate of return considerations than for a state. And for the state might take a point of view of infrastructure development as being an adequate return on the investment. Do you guys have a view of that or a framework that you're working within?
We will examine that as part of this report, but obviously, these are for-profit entities, and they have to make a return for their shareholders, so how they look at this project will be different than how the states will look at the projects for obvious reasons. And again, these are regulated. We're all certain it's going to be regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and they will have to get a lot of these issues will be determined by the federal government in terms of allowed rates of returns or maximum allowed rates of return. And so we'll have to see how that comes out. But in a regulated pipeline, of course, your opportunity for huge rates of returns generally are not there. It's going to be something in the 10 to 15% range, and certainly on the lower end of that, be my guess. But I don't know.
Go ahead, President Davis.
Just to follow up, I'm thinking more in terms of when we're evaluating the issue of whether or not the state should take ownership, what kind of rate of return should the state be looking at as a state, not as a private entity? And yeah. So have you had other considerations of that, or have you thought about that issue yet?
Not yet, no, sir. No, but what you're the question you're raising, though, is a very important one, however. Because the states get involved in these kinds of projects for lots of different reasons other than necessarily to make a high rate of return for its own income purposes. There are a lot of other strategic reasons why states should be involved.
Thank you.
Representative Fate.
Yes, you mentioned in passing the state's obligation to regulate the pipelines. Do you anticipate looking in depth at what effect any federal regulation may have upon those state regulations, whether they will be influence it to the extent perhaps that it would be impossible for the state to either regulate or even to enter into any financial agreements?
I think only indirectly, sir. I think that pretty much exceeds what we're trying to do. I think we're going to focus more on just the pure the things we know the state will have to regulate. And some of these other areas, I just think it's probably going to exceed the scope of this project. There are other people that can make comment on that probably better than I can or other people can.
I think Representative Fate will touch on that tomorrow with yes. our discussions with FERC and Bob Loeffler and the Department of Law and our legal people that are going to answer some of those, or at least take a shot at answering
Hopefully.
Some of those questions. So I'm not sure we'll get a clear answer, but. Anybody on teleconference? Senator Ellis, do you have any questions there? Anchorage?
Not at this time, but we have been joined by other folks here at the Anchorage office.
Okay.
And I'll get their names and pass them on later.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, you did give me a list of topics that you wanted to cover, and there's one that is in the letter that you sent me that really pertains to my sitting here right now, and that is, and I'll just read the question you posed. You said, representatives of the LNG sponsor group testified that the Port Authority concept provides little, if any, economic benefit to its project. Port Authority has stated that its structure is available to the producers and it can provide significant economic benefits to the project. What is your department's current view? Additionally, the Port Authority's route would cross land outside the participating municipalities' borders. What is your view of the Port Authority's jurisdiction outside their respective municipalities' borders? We're not ready to answer either of those questions. I can tell you that we are looking at a structure like the Port Authority as one of the models that we'll be analyzing to see whether it makes sense. And so we will have view on that issue, and I simply haven't turned my attention to the question of whether or not the Port Authority can construct a project that's partly outside the physical boundaries of the member municipalities.
Okay. Just for the members, I did write most of our testifiers' letters and pose questions to them to keep us online and keep us on point so we can and the commissioner is going to be back again tomorrow to answer some more tax questions and some other things, so I wasn't trying to keep you from answering that today. I just assumed we'd get into it tomorrow. But
okay.
I mean, to me, that seems to be a pretty cut-and-dry question on whether or not they have their testimony, and we'll get into this tomorrow, too, but their testimony was that they would be tax-exempt outside their jurisdictions, outside the city of Fairbanks or the municipality of Fairbanks. And I don't see where they would be, but that's what I was hoping you would have an answer for. But that's a difficult question, apparently.
Well, I don't know whether it's a difficult question or not. I apologize. I didn't address it.
Okay. Okay. What else? Anything else for?
I have one more.
Okay, go ahead, Representative Davis.
One more for Mr. Gardner, perhaps. Just a kind of setting the scene question from your corporate point of view. You commented on the sale of the Elk Hills and your role in Saudi Arabia. Both of those things move in the direction of privatization, which is the opposite of what part of the question we're considering here. Would you characterize your firm as being biased in that direction of privatization, or are you going to take a look at this from a fairly even-handed point of view?
Definitely even-handed. That's what our firm is known as. In fact, some people would say we're too even-handed. We are not in the pockets of anyone. We just presented projects and look at them and give people the answer, whether they want to hear that answer or not. And those particular projects, that was just the nature of the assignments. There's nothing to be drawn from there. And in fact, interestingly enough, I remember sitting in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, literally a year ago this week, debating some of the same issues in a very generic sense as I think you all will be debating in the legislature next year about the proper role of governments in these kinds of projects. And so even Saudi Arabia I wouldn't necessarily characterize as a privatization. It's more of a situation where the kingdom legitimately is trying to do the best thing for its country to increase employment, increase revenues available to the country, and exploit a valuable resource within the kingdom in a proper manner.
Thank you.
And I would assume that the commissioner's made available to you the past reports and studies that we've done on this.
Yes.
Because this is not the first time we've looked at this.
I understand, sir. Yes.
And I'm not totally sure what's changed from the last time to now, but other than the will to look at it again in the 2000 time frame, more or less. Okay, other questions? Okay, like I said, the commissioner will be back tomorrow. We'll get in more into some tax questions and some other things that he'll lead us through the discussion on. So to keep us on schedule, we will take a 15-minute break. At 2:30, we will be back for the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission for their presentation. So we will stand at ease.
Could have been added.
Or gas flaring. I think that most people have seen those pictures, and that's the traditional concept of waste.
Oh.
But Title 31 also defines waste to include the inefficient, excessive, or improper use of, or unnecessary dissipation of reservoir energy. It also means operating or producing in a way that reduces the amount of oil or gas recovered under operations conducted in accordance with good oil field engineering practices. Gas is currently reinjected for pressure maintenance in Prudhoe Bay. And if gas is sold instead of being reinjected, the state needs to know whether the loss of reservoir energy will result in reduced oil recovery. It's also important to know what alternatives may be available that could mitigate the loss of that reservoir energy. One of the specific questions that we were asked was with respect to the applicable conservation orders that currently exist. Back in 1994, the commission undertook a consolidation of the numerous conservation orders that had been written with respect to Prudhoe Bay. That has been amended twice since then, and it is referred to as Conservation Order 341C. There are two rules in that conservation order that specifically address the impact of gas offtake from Prudhoe Bay. One specifically is the pool maximum gas offtake rate, which is set at 2.7 billion standard cubic feet per day of gas offtake. That was written in 1977, and it contemplated at that time a 2 BCF pipeline sales rate. Rule 12 is what some of our staff refer to as the pressure decline speed limit. It specifically requires the operator to maintain the reservoir pressure at 250 psi above the minimum miscibility pressure. Separated and aside from gas sales, the operator is currently involved in what is referred to as a pressure studies initiative, or PSI, and they have begun initial information exchange with the commission on what their plans are. With respect to the current status of Rule 9, the Commission feels it's important to recognize that that rule was essentially written on information that was pre-1977. There has been a significant difference in the way that that reservoir is perceived today than it was back in the 70s when that rule was originally created. We believe that a gas offtake rule must be based on current knowledge and sound reservoir management. However, the timing for a hearing to revisit the offtake rule, we believe, depends on acquiring relevant data or an application from the operator. The operators have consistently stated over the last number of years to the AOGCC that early gas sales, they would expect to have a detrimental effect on oil recovery. Currently, the AOGCC has not been provided with any technical information regarding major gas sales or an application that specifically addresses timing or volumes. We anticipate a hearing with a BP reservoir group within the next 2 to 3 weeks for more detailed discussion on the types of information that we would expect to receive in order to evaluate a proposal. And we expect that a schedule would be set out at that meeting for when we could anticipate receiving that information. One of the points that our staff asked us to relate was that in the context of reservoir performance being so significantly different from the late 70s, the incremental recovery from Prudhoe Bay of the 3.5 million barrels of recoverable oil is the largest addition to reserves since Prudhoe Bay was discovered. The second was Kuparuk. And the 3.5 billion barrels is a significant amount. What the AOGCC did in preparation for what will subsequently be a major gas sale, the process that we prepared was a two-pronged process. The first was a scoping study to evaluate what and how that should be approached, how to determine and select an actual technical evaluation method and timing for proceeding with that. The gas sale scoping study was actually done this year. It was completed by Blaskovich Services in June of this year. The objectives of that review were to identify the conservation issues associated with gas sales from the Pruta oil pool, to identify the technical issues affecting ultimate hydrocarbon recovery, to consider the multiple complex interactive recovery mechanisms, and to provide alternatives to the AOGCC for technical evaluation and to provide a range of costs. The conclusion of Mr. Blaskovich's report, as some of you have seen, the oil recovery impact, his opinion was that the oil and condensate recovery would likely decrease under gas sales unless it was delayed until later in field life. However, he also believes that if it's carefully planned and managed, that the gas sales can extend field life and potentially increase total hydrocarbon recovery. So the mission for the commission and the challenge would be to make sure that we evaluate how it's being managed and look at the alternatives that are being proposed for maintaining reservoir pressure. The report also pointed out what is a natural tension between the state's desire to maximize hydrocarbon recovery and the owner's economics. Mr. Blaskovich also reviewed literature that had been available in the public domain as well as industry precedents and was able to find few industry precedents for early gas withdrawal before the end of field life in oil recovery. Although field management might be difficult with these proposals, he does believe that the endeavor could be successful. In his report, he also reviewed a number of options. His options were broken down into general categories, but they ranged from doing completely independent studies to a critique and peer review of the owner studies to working directly on the owner project teams. The ultimate recommendation that Mr. Blaskovich made in conjunction with his discussions with our technical staff is really a hybrid between two extremes, and the two extremes being the state doing a full field model, essentially duplicating effort that the companies have made at one end, and then at the other extreme, just accepting the information that the operators would provide to the commission. And the recommended approach, I would defer to Commissioner Huser to give you a better description of the technical aspects of that recommendation.
Mm-hmm. As Commissioner Taylor said, our current recommended approach is a two-prong approach. It's a hybrid that avoids either extreme. Our current thinking on this is that the type of evaluation that would provide the most value to our agency as well as to the state would be a combination of an independent analysis plus a critique of the working interest owner data and their results. And one of the messages that came through loud and clear in Mr. Blaskovich's scoping study was that the recovery from the Prudhoe Bay field is complex, and there are a variety of mechanisms going on. They're connected to each other, and they're interdependent upon each other. And they're currently in a delicate balance. And when you start to withdraw gas in the form of major gas sales, that delicate balance will be interrupted. So we need to make sure that we understand what these processes are. So our thinking is that we'll take and utilize smaller mechanistic models to understand how fluids are moving through the reservoir. And this will allow us to focus on technical issues that will have the greatest impact on the decisions. We won't look at everything, but we'll look at the important ones. As Cammie mentioned earlier, there has been little industry experience with major gas sales from a oil reservoir that has not finished producing oil. So there's really no place for us to go and look at actual experience. Some of the other technical issues that we'll be looking at are the timing of the gas sales. What are our pressure maintenance needs? One of the questions in our mind is ramp-up rates, ramp-up timing, offtake points. Right now, it appears that most of the gas could come from what used to be called the oil rim wells, but should there be a need for an increased gas sales rate, then what is the effect of taking gas off of the gas cap? We also want to look at the effect of gas withdrawal from the reservoir on the management of the existing water flood and enhanced oil recovery projects. Plus, our goal is to do a credible job. And in order to do that, you can't just simply evaluate the gas cap. You have to evaluate the reservoir. You have to evaluate not only the gas cap areas, but the gravity drainage areas, as well as those areas involved in water flood and EOR, because they all interact with each other. When you take fluids off of one portion, you get fluids moving in from another portion, and there may be a loss in oil recovery or condensate associated with moving fluids around. The ideal situation is to perform our evaluation concurrently with the owner studies, but we understand that the owners have already started their reservoir studies, and so we may be a little bit behind, but we feel like we can proceed at a pace that will allow us to not be an impediment to any gas sales decisions that will need to be made in the near future. And our ideal case would be to use the working interest owner data wherever we could. And this is necessary to independently validate, to assure ourselves that the data is as it should be and that the results are believable. That to make sure that we don't fall into that old computer talk of, you know, garbage in, garbage out. We want to know what's going in. We want to make sure that it is representative of what we believe the reservoir to be. That way we'll have more confidence in the results. We also propose to do a critique of the data and the results. It's effectively a peer review, and the credibility of our evaluation will be high if we study and ask the right questions. And that will allow us to feel comfortable that what is being proposed by the working interest owners really is in the best interest of the state to ensure greater ultimate hydrocarbon recovery. Timing issues. Now, this is one where we really don't have a fixed answer to your question, but I thought maybe I'd talk around it a little bit. Basically, with our current recommended approach, we believe that it's going to take about a year to study, to do the reservoir evaluation of the effects of major gas sales. The actual approval process is pretty straightforward. Once we receive a package and our evaluation is done, we put out a public notice and with minimum 30 days to respond, we'll hold a hearing, and then we have 30 days to issue a decision after the hearing. So that's basically how the process works. Now, there are some potential slowdowns to this, and that is access to operator information. As Commissioner Taylor mentioned, we have a meeting that is currently scheduled for sometime in the next 2 to 3 weeks to meet with representatives of the working interest owners and to provide them with additional clarification on our information requests. Also, It's going to be dependent upon availability of agency staff. As most of you are aware, we have had a very difficult time recruiting and filling our technical staff positions. We were very fortunate to obtain legislative approval for salary increases. We have filled one of our outstanding positions, but we are in the process of accepting applications for a second position. However, our workload our staffing levels never really reflected the need to do the major gas sales reservoir evaluation at this time. We've been told that it was always 5 years down the road or 7 years down the road. So there may be some additional staffing needs that we'll need to consider. Now, whether that be permanent employees or whether or not we use contractors, that would be something that we would need to evaluate, make sure that we're doing the right thing. Also, we need to have access to specialized experts that are both trained in and familiar with large-scale compositional reservoir modeling techniques. This is basically because in order for us to be effective in our critique of the working interest owner data and results, these are the type of models that they're using. They're very sophisticated, and they're fairly new within the last 10, 15 years or so, and it takes specialized experience in order to to evaluate their results.
Mr. Chairman, one of the questions that was asked of us was with respect to the status of any discussion with the Prudhoe Bay lessees regarding what orders or permits that they will need in order to develop and produce gas for sale, including the volume of gas available for sale at the startup of a gas pipeline and the commencement of full blowdown of the gas cap. We have a very general answer, and right now the information we have received in our discussions with the operators has been very general. We have had a general outline provided to us of when they expect to be reviewing certain things, but there has been no specific data, specific outline with respect to timing or volumes. And so currently we're at the outside waiting to get the beginnings of information so that we can then start evaluating what their proposal is. We hope that in the meeting that is scheduled within the next 2 to 3 weeks that we will have a better layout of the roadmap ahead, and that it would be easier to plug in some time frames. The last question that we were asked was to explain how the AOGCC intended to fund on a program receipt fee basis the study for which the AOGCC previously had requested $500,000 in general funds, and an explanation of the scope of the study. The scope of the study, actually, I think, as Commissioner Huser just described, is somewhat dependent on what the actual parameters will be once the operators come in to us with a specific proposal and timing. But it will be within that model of the hybrid, the two-prong hybrid that she described. Currently, the AOGCC funding request that went through the legislature last year was made part of the overall gas line package. And it's our understanding now that what the Department of Natural Resources will be doing is actually entering into an agreement with the producers, and they will collect from the producers through their statutory designated program receipt authority and then RSA that to the AOGCC.
Okay. Anything else?
We don't have anything additional right now. We'd be happy to answer questions, and we would also like to extend an invitation to members of the committee if there is ever an opportunity you would like to take up with respect to inquiring about more technical information or speaking with our staff. We'd invite you to come to our offices. We'd be happy to show you around or provide you with any additional information.
Okay, great. Let me start out with questions, and then we'll go to the panel. Maybe this should just have you start. You lost me in the beginning of the process. You need an application from the producers before you're going to go forward. You mentioned that in your early testimony, that you'd start once you got an application in. Now, that was, I believe, on the study of whether or not Prudhoe, you know, you can let the gas go out at 4 billion a day or whatever. But make that a little clearer for me.
I'll try to back that up. I think with respect to revisiting Rule 9, which currently sets an amount of gas as a gas limit for offtake, the commission has, for a number of years, felt that that rule was no longer current. The commission has not moved to reevaluate that rule until such time as we either had an application or more specific information about the reservoir and about proposed plans with which to make a better informed rule about what amount and at what time gas could be taken from the reservoir. And that would be also dependent upon what alternatives the operators had for reservoir energy replacement.
And to go on to your timing issues, that depends on whether or not you get the information from the operators?
Timing.
Am I tying the two in together, or are they separate?
With respect to the actual technical review, mm-hmm. The proposal, the recommendation for the kind of hybrid review that Commissioner Huser described is dependent on the information that would be provided by the operators.
But you need that to amend Rule 9. That's where I'm going with this. Do you need Commissioner Huser's report to amend for the data you need to make a decision on amending Rule 9?
To do it intelligently. Otherwise, I think that you could just delete the rule and wait until someone came with a proposal and further information.
So your timeline would be a year. You said it'd take you a year to do this. A year after what?
A year after we receive some detailed information from the working interest owners.
And then you'd theoretically get this information from the operators, and then you're going to make sure it's correct somehow or another, hire the right people to
yes.
to make sure. And that would take a year from the time you get. That's assuming you don't need any additional data, I suppose.
That is our best understanding at the moment. The more information that were provided, perhaps that time frame would be shorter, but based on the hybrid approach that we'd like to take, we're estimating a year.
Well, the opinion time, do you find it, I find it a little bit odd that the producers aren't addressing you a little bit in meetings up front on whether or not you're even going to amend Rule 9. Is this an assumption on their part that they can pump whatever it is, 6 billion 6 billion feet a day out of the field without, and you're going to approve that, or what's your opinion of that? Okay, you don't have to answer that. Tell by the look. Well, it fits with their MO because they're not sharing a lot of information on anything. But let me ask you just a couple more questions, and then we'll go to the panel. I'm assuming that your decision has a little bit to do with the economics of the it's the loss of oil versus the increase in gas. So it comes down to the question of economics, you know, the most to the Treasury, I would assume, or the biggest benefit to Alaska. How do you weigh that? In other words, let's say you lose a million feet a day, but you gain all this gas sales and our Treasury gets more money in the end result. Is that what's driving your decision? Would be what's to the Treasury?
Actually, Title 31 doesn't provide us with any opportunity to balance the economics of it. Title 31 directly addresses hydrocarbon recovery, and so that comparison or that evaluation is left to other departments and the legislature. Our evaluation is to look at avoiding waste and promoting that ultimate recovery within reason, and of course to the extent that we're not doing it blindly of what the costs are. But
so
that's
would,
part
would
of the
would a 10% loss of oil production be something you would approve or not approve? If for a pick any, I don't care how much gas, but if it was 10% loss in oil production, does that meet your criteria of maximum hydrocarbon recovery? Or what is the percent? Okay, that's another tough one.
Well, I don't think there's a magic answer. And I think that one of the things that I think people find most surprising is that when you have a pool of oil in the ground and someone is developing that, they don't recover 100% of that. And perhaps Ms. Huser can address sort of the specifics of what's normally expected and where this fits in. So I think there's an element of reasonableness and an element of, you know, sound engineering principles.
This is a difficult question to answer about what's a reasonable amount of oil to give up in exchange for a major gas sales at Prudhoe Bay. Previous public testimony by both operators and working interest owners have suggested that the oil loss is at least 500 million barrels now, which is, that's a chunk of oil. What percentage of it is it of the original oil in place? Well, in the grand scheme of things, it is, I haven't done my math, but it is, it's not 10%, it is less than 10%. The 500 million barrels of potential lost oil and condensate, that is a low-end number that we have heard testimony on before. Is a 10% loss reasonable? 1%? 1% of the current recoverable reserves at Prudhoe Bay is, 10% is about 1.4 billion barrels. It's a lot. So 5% is 700 million barrels. So that just kind of, you know, gives you some points of reference. We don't know at this time what the what a reasonable figure is for loss of oil and condensate reserves. There is oil in the gas cap, what's called relic oil. When you start taking gas off, you get fluids moving around, so you lose oil because you've moved them further away from where they were originally deposited. So I just in general can talk around. That will be a point of discussion. What is a reasonable trade?
I know you're kind of chasing that answer around, and there isn't one, so I'll accept that. It sounded like, Ms. Taylor, in your testimony, that there was another agency that could override your decisions. The legislature maybe being one, but with our legislative power. But is there anybody that can veto your decision and okay a gas sale if you, or did I misunderstand what you said?
I guess our position right now would be that without authorization from the commission, they would be at least in violation of Title 31.
Right. Okay. Well, does DNR, for example, anybody else have a say in whether or not what limits of hydrocarbons are recoverable? I mean, can the governor call you and say, make it work, and you do it? Or how does this work?
There is no one out there who could call us and tell us, make it work. DNR can certainly appear as a party in front of the commission and provide testimony. And I think I'd also like to add that part of the evaluation that is part of this difficult question about what's lost and what's not is also a challenge for the commission to evaluate what other alternatives might be out there with respect to mitigating that loss of oil recovery when the gas is taken for sale. And that's part of this process of the evaluation, and it's part of, I'm fairly certain, what the companies are also looking at.
One last question. How much of this information is confidential? Is all the operator information confidential, or is it public when you get it?
The Commission's confidentiality provisions, generally with respect to subsurface information on particular wells, is governed by generally a 24-month confidentiality. So the subsurface information that relates to a particular well 24 months after it's been drilled, after they've completed the well, is available publicly. There is some technical information that, if provided voluntarily under Title 31, can be held confidential. The other general aspect is under the general statutory trade secret requirements, and some of that information, they have to meet a certain standard, but if they meet that, that can be maintained confidentially.
Okay, thank you. Representative Davies, and anybody else, then Representative Hogan.
You talked a little bit about the Blaskovich study, and he sort of said two apparently contradictory things in your summary here. One is that oil recovery is likely to decrease, and that if it's carefully planned, that it could extend the life and increase recovery. So it sounds like he assumes it's not going to be carefully planned. But I guess the question, my real question is in reading that study, what do you agree that there are things that we could do that with carefully planned gas recovery would actually enhance oil recovery? And what are those things?
One of the provisions of a conservation order 341C is that the working interest owners continue to evaluate pressure maintenance options. One of their recent proposals to us has been called the Pressure Support Initiative, which is basically gas cap water injection. That is one way that pressure decline can be mitigated. There are also optimizing your field production rates, where you physically take your reservoir fluids from, is another means that can be used to manage reservoir pressure decline or reservoir energy decline. There are a number of things that could be done.
So do you fundamentally agree with that statement that that a carefully planned gas sale could increase total hydrocarbon recovery?
There's a timing question. So in essence, that is correct. The timing of the gas sale, if it's somewhere off in the future, gives you more opportunity to recover your hydrocarbons and to cycle gas and recover additional hydrocarbons from your gas cap. So there's the timing issue, carefully planned. And then there's the pressure or reservoir energy mitigation issues that can help maintain the reservoir pressure, maintain the reservoir energy, and allow you to recover. I'm not saying it's necessarily more oil, but you would recover, or you would lose less.
So, and the number 500 million, is that kind of the right order of magnitude? And are we talking about Prudhoe Bay there, or the entire North Slope?
That number is just Prudhoe Bay, and I guess I would defer to Commissioner Taylor on that one. There's a range quoted.
I think the range we've heard historically has been 400 to 500,000, but it has been very, at least in the context that we have heard it, has been very loosely used with no identifiable date at which that gas would begin to be taken off the reservoir.
So order of magnitude a year's recovery.
Based on the current production rate, yes.
Representative Ogun.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You just said 400 to 500,000. Did you mean 400 to 500 million?
I did.
Okay. And the total reserves was what, about 5,000 million or 5 billion right now in Prudhoe Bay?
Total current estimated recoverable reserves are about 13 billion.
Okay.
Oil.
That's just in Prudhoe?
Yes.
Okay. That's differs quite a bit from what BP just put out in their statistical review of U.S. energy in 2001. They're saying 4,900 million or 4.9 billion barrels. But and I guess the 500 million figure was based.
Excuse me. Let me qualify that.
Okay.
That's their estimated recoverable reserves. Are we comparing apples to apples here?
Right. So that's recoverable?
Yes.
Is about 5,000 million or 5 billion?
Recoverable, estimated recoverable oil reserves are in the neighborhoods of 13 billion. There was like 23 billion oil in place, and they expect to recover something on the order of 13 billion of that.
Now, this 500 million figure, was that based on draw 2 BCF? That's what's been touted kind of in the past. It would be a $500 million loss. But in the past, they've been talking about 2 BCF, right? Now we're talking 4. So does that affect it significantly?
The 500 million barrel potential loss came with no qualifiers, except that Rule 9 does allow for gas sales of 2 BCF per day, which equates to something like 2.7 BCF per day offtake. So, you know, if you're comparing apples to apples, we believe that's the correct context.
And if I might, Mr. Chairman, just one follow-up.
Oh.
Wouldn't it be logical, and I'm not a petroleum engineer, but seems to me if you draw down twice as much gas as what that rule allows, that you're going to have more of a loss faster?
Well, when you take out twice as much gas, your pressure decline does accelerate, and oil recovery is a function of pressure decline. So is it linear? I don't know the answer to that. And I just had a note from Mark Myers. What you're seeing in your report right there is BP is quoting remaining reserves, and what I quoted you was total reserves. So they are pretty much saying the same thing.
All right. Okay. Well, I'd be kind of curious to see what, you know, how it pencils out with an over 4 BCF draw, what the total loss would be. I'm sure that you guys are interested in that as well. So.
That is one of the things that we will be taking a look at, the effect of gas offtake or gas sales rate on the various recoveries.
Thank you.
Other questions? Senator Kelly.
How much will water be able to replace the gas that might be removed? Is that an unknown technology?
It's not an unknown technology, and I'm going to have to talk around this one too, and so I beg your forbearance here. The Pressure Support Initiative will put gas in the gas cap area, and that will be a means to help the reservoir pressure decline level off. However, in the water flood areas where we're currently injecting water, our voidage, our oil and water produced from those areas, is more than the water and gas being injected into those areas. And the very simple reason behind that is reservoir management. When you over-inject, you move fluids from one area to another, and you have the potential to lose recovery. So it's not so simple as a, you know, you take one barrel of fluid out or equivalent gas and put one barrel of water in. It's never that easy. It's a function of where you do it and how you manage your reservoir.
So water is never going to be able to replace gas. In some circumstances, you'll be able to use it, but you can't count on...
Boy, I hate to use the word never. Uh-huh. You know, those are the kinds of statements that come back and slap sure. you in the back
are
of the head.
Are there other reasons why water wouldn't be used? Are there environmental reasons? Are there, I mean, let's say tomorrow they found a way to effectively replace gas with water. Are there other reasons why you wouldn't use water? I guess effectively replace it. In other words, you could get the water out of the ground, or the gas out of the ground, excuse me, the oil out of the ground. But
excuse me, this is Sandy in Anchorage. We can't hear you.
Shall I start from the top? Are there other reasons why you couldn't use water? And I'm thinking of environmental reasons, I guess.
I am not really the person to address that. I am not familiar with any environmental reasons that would preclude, except there may be some limit on the amount of seawater that can be taken from Prudhoe Bay and be available for gas cap water injection. I understand their plans are to use seawater as opposed to produced water.
I think that with respect to the areas in which we regulate the underground injection of water for purposes of enhanced recovery, there aren't any as long as the proposal is done according to our regulatory criteria. And I'm not aware of there being any difficulties in the Prudhoe area for mechanically with respect to environmental regulations. And that deals with the potential sources of drinking water, and we're not aware of any.
Thank you.
Other questions? Any questions in Anchorage? Senator Ellis?
There's no questions here, but maybe for the next session we could, we really had a hard time through that whole last one, hearing everyone.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Davies.
Can you go back to the question of timing and when you can actually begin the study? Obviously, you need to have data and you need to have a more specific idea what the development plan would be before a study would be optimal. But are there other things that you could be doing now following on the scoping study that would prepare you for that to move ahead? And are you doing those things? Are there ways to jumpstart the process to hopefully keep the required
keep
amount
the
of time
line.
To a year?
Would you like to answer that?
Absent information, any sort of technical data, one of the reasons for the recommendation that we actually use the technical data provided by the operator that they use to build their models was so that you'd had some consistency. A lot of technical information is provided by the operator to the state. The time it would take to put that information in a useful fashion to do that same exercise would be fairly overwhelming at this point. Our hope is to actually move forward on a decision about how to proceed with this evaluation so that we can actually begin the procurement process in terms of getting an RFP out there and finding out more specifically what it would cost and who's out there available to do this kind of work. And hopefully that can be lined up ahead of time. We'll have a better indication in the next 2 to 3 weeks when we actually meet with the reservoir group at BP to hear more specifically about what their timing schedule looks like.
Follow up.
Using the working interest owner data and quality checking that basically eliminates disagreements.
Can you...
Streamlines that process.
Can you request that data in advance of an application?
Yes.
I mean, can you anticipate the sort of data you're going to need and just simply request it?
Yes, in fact, we have done that. We have written to the operator and specifically outlined the type of information that we're looking for and requested from them a confirmation on the timing that we could expect to have that information. And that is what's prompting this meeting in approximately 2 to 3 weeks.
Good. Thank you.
Representative Fate.
Yeah, I just have a comment. In several hearings, it was stated that by the owners that 4 BCF per day would have little or no effect on oil production. And I'm making a statement. I'm a little bit concerned about this timing that has been brought up here, because we've been going under this illusion that they've been doing a study that there's going to be at least 4 BCF, and they've even discussed 6. And so here we are now backing up, talking about Rule 9 and what has to be done to confirm either whether or not 2.7 billion a day is going to decrease or 4 billion is going to decrease the production of the remaining oil in Prudhoe Bay. And to me, Mr. Chairman, it's backing up the cart here when we need to go forward with it. And we've been discussing 4 billion. Apparently it's been an illusion. Is that correct? Is this an illusion?
We're not privy to the information about the 4 BCF a day. Are you hearing that the 4 BCF are to be coming from the Prudhoe field, or are they coming from other places as well?
No, we understand the Prudhoe field, because that's where most of the gas will be coming from. And we've been told this. So we just took it, or at least I certainly took it, to mean that there had been certainly studies on whether or not 4 BCF would, in fact, diminish the production of the oil.
I guess we would be hopeful then that if the studies have already been done, when we meet with them in 2 to 3 weeks, we would anticipate receiving information relatively quickly.
Yeah, and I don't know if they've really finished the studies, but I do know that we've plugged different numbers in for loss of oil in certain economic models that we've been running on the production, and most of those come from conversations with the producers that would, or other places that would show a loss. But I understand Representative Fate's displeasure with finding out that there's a lot more hoops to jump through to sell gas than what you'd think. Some of the stuff would already been thought out and done before you. Or maybe a better way to put it would, there's certain steps you would do first, and one is to get approval to sell it, the field approval from you folks before you'd go out and spend $100 million to even see if you want to do it. It seems like a logical step to go through. But that was one reason that I scheduled and asked you folks, and I'm very appreciative that you came up to testify, is that, because, you know, I was hearing that a lot of disconcern about what's happening as far as working with you guys and trying to get the regulatory process working correctly from the producers to what we have to go through. So, any other questions of our panel?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Go ahead, Representative Hogan.
A follow-up on one of the questions you asked about who could possibly, whether a phone call from the governor or, whatever. I mean, I'm sure that what you need to do is follow the statute, but I suppose your decision could be litigated in court, I would assume, and overruled by the courts?
That is correct. Any decision made by the commission can be appealed to the Superior Court.
And they're real experts, no doubt, on the issue. But anyway, thank you very much.
And thank you, for joining us this afternoon, flying up and doing this. And I, for one, will take you up on your offer to come by and visit. And probably right after the producers leave, I may come in right after that and see if I can get some hot information right off the press. So,
We're looking for information from you.
I would appreciate if you would keep us informed as to what, my office would call when the meeting, after the meeting takes place, so I could get maybe a briefing from you. Or our next meeting will probably be in late September for this committee, and it may be worthy to review that meeting that you had and have your take on that and bring that out in the public and go ahead and schedule that as part of our next meeting also. So we'll talk about that, though. So thank you very much. We're going to take a short break. Our next up is Jack Griffin, the Assistant Attorney General. We'll make the questions available that we asked him. They'll be on the back as the other one, and we'll start promptly at 3:30. So 5 minutes.
Mr. Chairman, if my staff and Juno is listening, would you call me on my cell phone, please?
Okay. All right. Thanks. It's a Reggie smoke break. Yep. All right, panel members, if you would come back up, wherever you are, smoke break. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Senator. How are you?
Yeah, our next panel is going to be Jack Griffin. He's the Assistant Attorney General for Natural Resources, and again, I wrote a series of questions that I asked him to get his answers on, and I believe those questions are on the back table there if you wish to look through those and follow through. And I believe your response is also, did we pass that out to the public, do you know? Okay, so his response to the questions are also back there. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jack and let him walk through his answers.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Before we get going. I talked with Juno, and they had a real hard time hearing the presenters. The people on the panel were fairly clear, but I guess if you can get really close, they'd like to hear what you have to say.
Okay, I will. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Jack Griffin, G-R-I-F-F-I-N. I'm the head of the oil, gas, and mining section of the Anchorage, in Anchorage, in the Department of Law. And as the chairman said, the chairman did send a number of questions to me, many of which dealt with overlifting and underlifting. And the overlifting questions were, I think, prompted, at least in part, by Senate Concurrent Resolution 10 that dealt with a proposal by an entity called Netricity, which had a rather interesting idea for a gas development project on the North Slope involving an internet server farm. And I thought it might be helpful to discuss first, just in general terms, what overlifting and underlifting is. I know that most members of the committee are familiar with that, but there may be some folks who are interested in this who aren't familiar with the terms. And generally speaking, overlifting and underlifting are terms that are used by parties with interests in oil and gas production to describe situations where they either take more or less than their allocable share of production, usually from a particular field. And we're talking about production in a given production period. To know whether you've overlifted or underlifted, you're looking at a particular production period and asking whether you've gotten more or less than your share. Now, generally speaking, when one party with production interests in a field is overlifting, the other party or parties in that field will be underlifting. There usually isn't a situation, although it's I suppose possible by agreement, but there usually isn't a situation where one person is overlifting and the other parties or working interest owners are taking just their allocable share. So just as an example, if you have two people with interests, production interests in a field, and they each have equal interests, so that each of them is entitled, say, to take 50% of the production in any given month. If, say, A incurs, we're talking about parties A and B, A incurs some marketing or other transportation disruptions, Party A may find at the end of the month that they have actually underlifted their production. Maybe A has only taken 45% of the production instead of 50%. Party B then may have overlifted its production, having taken 55% of the production instead of its allocable share of 50%. Now, parties with interest in production often agree in advance how they're going to address situations like this. Eventually, reconciliation of the interests must occur. And if you have a standalone agreement that addresses just this, you'd probably call it a balancing agreement. There are a number of different ways you can balance these interests, but I think probably the most common ways are to adjust going forward the amount of production you would take in subsequent production periods, or you could just have cash payments to balance the disproportionate taking. So in our example, where A took 45% in a month instead of 50%, you might flip it around. In the next month, you'd give A 55%, and B would take 45%. So then over that two-month period, each has taken 50%, assuming the production each month is the same. That's one way of doing it. Another way of doing it is B, the overlifter in the example, could just pay cash to Party A for the extra 5% that the overlifter took in that particular month. That's another common way of addressing the balancing question. Now, there are a number of different causes for overlifts and underlifts. In my answers, I've kind of listed some of these causes that commentators have noted. They include but are not limited to things like marketing problems of one or more of the parties. Governmental action in the form of legislation or regulation might cause a party to overlift or underlift. Disruption or absence of facilities for accepting an owner's share of production for some period of time is a cause. Inability or refusal of a purchaser to take delivery of an owner's share of production. Unanticipated cessation or decline of production, drainage. And then you also have things like variations among the parties as to information, expectation, or their risk aversion. So as you can see from most of these examples, overlifts and underlifts often occur because of unforeseen circumstances or what I've referred to as slight hiccups in the day-to-day operations of a field. But you can also plan for an overlift or an underlift and specifically negotiate in advance how the overlifting or underlifting might occur and then how the balancing of that might occur. For example, parties with varying interests in production from a number of different pools in a field may use overlifts and underlifts instead of cash payments in order to try and equalize their interests across a field. That's essentially what happened at Prudhoe Bay following the BP-ARCO merger and the acquisition of ARCO's Alaskan assets by Phillips. There was a period of overlifting and underlifting in order to accomplish the realignment of interest among most of the working interest owners in that field. Now, I've described overlifts and underlifts as essentially applying to parties with interests in production. Does the state have an interest in production at Prudhoe Bay? Of course it does. The state has a royalty interest in the oil and gas that is produced at Prudhoe Bay. Under our leases, that royalty interest attaches to gas that is produced and saved and sold or used off the lease. Gas that is used for repressuring the reservoir and gas that is used for enhanced oil recovery does not incur a royalty obligation. And generally speaking, our royalty interest under the leases at Prudhoe Bay is 12.5%. So with that introduction, then I'll just move directly to your questions, Mr. Chairman. And this series of questions deal with overlifting. And the first question is, are there any statutory provisions that are relevant? If so, what are they and why? Well, the answer to that question is that there are no statutory provisions that directly address a right by the state to overlift oil or gas at Prudhoe Bay or any other field in the state. Now, consistent with the general powers held by the commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources under Alaska Statutes 3805, we believe that the commissioner does have the inherent authority to negotiate an overlifting agreement.
Senator Kelly.
Can you give me underlift and overlift?
Speaking of the mic.
The regular table mics in Juneau. Can you give me underlift and overlift 101 real quickly before you get into these questions? Well, it didn't. You lost me.
Sure. If we think about the state's royalty interest, for example, let's just assume that it's 12.5% each month. Let's say in a month, and you know the example may get a little twisted here, but let's assume that we are taking the gas in kind and marketing it ourselves. It makes it a little bit easier to talk about. If in a particular month we find that we have taken not 12.5%, but let's say 12% of the gas, because we had a customer who went south on us, or we had a little problem with a delivery somewhere, we would have underlifted our gas for that month. We'd be short gas that month. And now, as a consequence, the other folks with interests in gas that was produced from Prudhoe Bay probably would have taken a little bit more. They'd be in an overlift situation. There's got to be a way to make us even. One way to make us even would be that in the next production period, maybe we take a little bit more than 12.5%. You know, maybe we take 13%, or maybe we take a small fraction more than 12.5% for several months until we made it up. And the other parties with interest in production might take a little bit less.
Or you say that can be done with cash.
It can be done with cash. And so I hope folks will interrupt if I stumble across something or am unclear on something.
Just a clarification on that. In the other scenario where you've got the two companies, one underlifting, one overlifting, do we attach the royalty that's appropriate, so that we a royalty on the 45% from Company A and a royalty on the 55% from Company B in that month, or do we assess the royalty as if they had produce the right amount?
Well, I think that the answer to that question is in most circumstances where the overlifts and underlifts are the little burps or blips in production, we don't pay attention to that. If someone has a 30% share in production, you know, the royalty is going to be based on that share, and we probably won't look at, you know, whether they, you know, because of a slight blip, they've overlifted or underlifted in a particular month. Now, a different approach might apply if, for example, the parties have negotiated to overlift or underlift for an extended period. It's not an operational blip, but it's part of their negotiated arrangements. We would probably look at that arrangement and ask the question, how should our royalty interest apply? And then we'd go talk to them about it. And it might go either way. It might go either way.
Well, we might have a different interest in the different shares, and so it might make
exactly.
a difference.
That's exactly right. That's why we might look at it differently. Now, and that's why I try to draw the distinction between, you know,